Good evening, everybody. Please sit however you can best listen to a talk, and feel free to look in this direction or turn in this direction. So, when I came here this evening, I knew I was giving a talk, but I wasn't. But there were kind of four different Dharma talks in my head that maybe I could give. And I dealt with that by asking Kate for ideas for what Dharma talk I should give, and she gave me a bunch of different ideas, and then that clarified for me that I didn't want to do those. and instead, I'm actually going to not. I'm also not going to do any of the ideas I had coming here, throwing them all away. And it's so exciting that we are drawing what are for us capacity crowds here. I remember when we this group has been around 5 or 6 years, and the first much of the first year, I would do an orientation every week for a new person, and would each week sincerely hope somebody would come back. And each week I kind of lived in a kind of dread that nobody was going to come. That never actually happened, that the number of people plus me was zero or just but it was often two or three folk, and it was always particularly exciting when somebody came a second time, and then we had a few who started coming regularly, and I could panic less before. But I would sit with all of the instruments kind of arrayed out in front of me, and the timekeeper bell and the big bell and the little drum and the other little thing, clappers, just a big pile of stuff, my gear. But tonight, what I want to talk about a little bit, I think, is each of the pieces of the short liturgy, which is the liturgy that we did tonight, plus the piece that we're going to do at the end of the talk. This is our short liturgy. If you'd never done liturgy before, not any kind of chanting practice, I'm sure this felt like a very long liturgy. But every other week, when we are doing interviews rather than the talk here, we'd actually do a lengthier liturgy, and it takes up a full sitting period of around 25 minutes. I'll say a little bit about liturgy in general, each of the pieces in specific, and I want to start, though, with the first part of our liturgical ceremony, which is bowing. And I know Kate gave a talk a couple of weeks ago about touching on that, but I just want to touch on it briefly. Part of what this does, so when we're bowing, we are not, of course, bowing to anything outside of ourselves. We're not being we're not being less than, we're not submitting to. But bowing is nonetheless a very important part of our practice. And part of the reason we do it, also, even in our short liturgy practice, is because it is powerful. And Zen practice, like life, is not something that's done with mind alone. It is mind and body together. Mind, body, and universe, in fact, together. We don't separate out mind from body. How we use our body affects what goes on in our mind, and the way we use our mind is expressed in our body. One of the ways that we most directly see this is that we sit still in zazen. We don't do the zazen of any of those things. Although you certainly could, perhaps not in this group. This stillness, the stillness of zazen, the stillness of the body, enables us to touch a different kind of quality of mind. which is not to say that we're trying to still our mind by stilling the body. Zazen is not about stilling the mind, quieting the mind, or emptying the mind. But how we use our body matters. The act of bowing is evocative of something, which doesn't mean that you're supposed to be feeling some special thing when you're bowing. You might be feeling, God, I really hate bowing. And if that's the case, that is bowing doing its job. Or you might be, you might just notice, bring your attention fully to the bowing. You might notice when you're telling a story and then return to the physicality of that bowing. And that too is practice. That too is bowing doing its job. Or, and another place, another subtle place I just want to touch on where we see the effect, where we pay particular attention to the link between body and mind, is in the portion of the posture that's the mouth. So part of the Zazen posture, just like sitting up straight, shoulders open and down, part of the Zazen posture is a slight smile on the mouth. The thought of a smile, a hint of a smile. And this is not about trying to plaster some emotional experience onto whatever you are in fact feeling. It's a practice of meeting what you're feeling, however it is, with that posture of body. And that posture of body evokes a kind of cast of mind as well. And so we may be practicing Zazen of darkness and despair and depression and pain. And we meet that with the posture of Zazen, with the thought of a smile on our mouth. Part of what that does is release the tension in your face, among other things. So, body, mind, not separate. Bowing creates a beginning. It acknowledges we're here now, we're beginning, we're taking up this practice, which is significant and meaningful and deeply, deeply valuable. Even if we're not sure exactly how that may be true, even if we haven't verified for ourselves exactly how that may be true, what draws us to this practice, and certainly what draws us back that second time, if there is one, is a sense that there is something significant going on here. And that is part of what bowing at the beginning of the liturgy teaches us, reminds us of, helps us ritually demarcate, ritually indicate. One of the ancient teachers of the Japanese lineages that we're related to said that as long as there is bowing, the Dharma will not diminish. The teachings themselves will not diminish. Bowing's that important. I'm going to come back, I think, to the first chant we did, the Gatha of Atonement. And a Gatha is a Sanskrit word for a short verse. what the heck? I'll go in order. So the Gatha of Atonement. So liturgy can do many things. Liturgy is a body practice. It grounds us into our body. We might, without liturgy, without walking meditation, without bowing, we might imagine that this endeavor is wholly something that the mind does, but it's not. Liturgy grounds us in our body. We chant from the same place that we breathe into. We get the energy and breath moving. It's a practice of the coming together of the many and the one. In Buddhism, these are two ways of describing all that is. This is sometimes called the two truths, the truths of the absolute and the truths of the relative. And our practice is being with both truths, not preferring one over the other. And so the fact that this is all the universe, our bodies, minds, and the universe itself is all one bright pearl. It's one thing, one body. That's the absolute, that's the one. And also within that, the truth of the fact that we are all one, inextricably, also is the fact that we're separate. There are differentiations. Both are true. Chanting embodies that. It's the many voices coming together as one, and one voice expressing itself through many voices. The one and the many. We're actualizing the truth of that. Chanting is also a community practice. We do it together. And as such, it holds and supports us. It helps us feel each other as community, as support. And then chanting does other things. It sometimes, the speech act, the things that we are saying are, have their own, effect, their own power, or the Buddhist word for that might be their own karma. There is karma in doing what, in saying these words, in using our minds and bodies in this way. And karma just means actions together with their effects. In the Buddhist worldview, action and effects are both the same thing. They're not separable. And then there's another function of liturgy, which is that it has a teaching function. Sometimes there is an explicit didactic component in it, something that has been useful or clearly or well expressed by any of the generations and generations, centuries and millennia of ancestors to us on this path. The act of chanting them or reciting them helps them kind of lodge into your mind on a different level, lodge into your, maybe your body, into your cells. And then, even if your experience is not necessarily of understanding of them, they kind of work an effect. They may bubble up at some moment and you may see them in a new light. So the first chant that we do, the Gatha of Atonement, is a enacted chant. It's a speech act. It's a doing of something. And the thing that we are doing is atoning. We are practicing atonement. And the word atonement literally is composed of the words at-one-ment. It is a practice of acknowledging that this is the place we start from. This, right here, all of the beginningless past, the past, the infinite vectors of causes and conditions that have given rise to this moment, this body, this mind, right here we are at one with that. And this at one, this being at one meant, being at one is not some special state of mind. It's not about trying to feel at one with the universe. We are one with the universe, regardless of what we feel. But it's not trying to create that kind of special state of mind. It's acknowledging that here is the place that we start. Here is where we practice. And we say all evil karma. Again, this is that word karma. And we use this very provocative word, evil. And I could give a whole Dharma talk on that. But for this introductory kind of talk, or this overview talk, we can hear the word evil as just standing in for suffering-causing, suffering-inducing, harm-causing. And it doesn't matter whether the harm is inward or outward. All harm-causing actions and their consequences ever committed by me since of old. And the since of old is, as we say in the next line, beginningless, beginningless, beginningless. Beyond not just since yesterday, not just even since our lifetime, but all of these causes and conditions in the universe which have been flowing down to here. We're taking responsibility for all of it. We're owning it and starting afresh. We one of the other recitations we do in our longer ceremonies talks about how even one moment of zazen wipes away beginningless crime. And that's related to that. But first, before we can wipe away, we have to let it all in. And then, of course, this isn't something that we do once and for all, and then we're all set. We do it continually. I can create some suffering-causing karma in between verses of the second and third repetition. You know, I can get it right in there. And on account of my beginningless greed, anger, and ignorance. And we don't even necessarily need that word "my" there. We could just say on account of beginningless greed, anger, and ignorance. And these words, greed, anger, and ignorance, these are what are called in Buddhism the three poisons. These are the three modalities of energy that cause suffering in the world. And the kind of the most provocative forms are greed, anger, and anger, the words for them. But we can also think of them as grasping, aversion, and righteous certainty is another name for ignorance. Or we might say the stories that we tell ourselves, or believing our thoughts to be truths in themselves rather than just seeing them as thoughts. That's another way of understanding ignorance. These are the three poisons. All suffering from ourselves, all suffering caused in the world, all evil karma arises only ever from these three things. And noticing how we get caught in the continual arising of grasping, aversion, and certainty, grasping, aversion, and stories, seeing this happening, unhooking from that, reorienting ourselves to who we mean to be, this is the continual practice of the Dharma in our everyday life. This is not about extinguishing greed, anger, and ignorance. It's working with those energies in a flexible and creative fashion rather than being owned by them, worked by them, moved around like a puppet by them. Born of my body, mouth, and thought, these are the three means through which we create karma, wholesome or unwholesome karma. So anger can be expressed by punching someone in the face. It can be expressed by saying, "Boy, I really want to punch you in the face." Or it can be expressed by thinking, "Man, I'm really going to enjoy punching." And all of those create karma. And so one of the teachings here is that, and it's true that the karma is greater, it is heavier if it is karma of body than if it is karma of speech. And the karma of speech is greater than the, or heavier or more substantial than karma of thought. But all of them do create karma and can be the causes of suffering or liberation. And the teaching here, one of the teachings here, is that what you do with your mind matters. How you talk to yourself matters. Now I atone for it all. Now I am at one with it all. Now I am. This is the place I start from. all the messes that I've made from beginning this past, all the messes, all the difficulties of my family going back for generations, our culture, our society, our civilization, our species, all have created suffering, karma, and all of it comes to a head in this moment. And here we take responsibility for the whole catastrophe. We are at one with the whole mess. And this practice of atoning is crucial, crucial, crucial to our practice of the Dharma. I've given a bunch of talks on atoning, so I'm not going to say more about that right now. I do want to say to everybody that there is a library of Dharma talks, both on the Boston Zen website of talks that have been given here and on the Boundless Way Zen website of talks that have been given elsewhere throughout our community. And then we go to the three refuges. And we do these in a language called Pali, which is a spoken, it's a particular spoken dialect of the ancient Indian language of Sanskrit. We do them in Pali and we do them in English. Part of the reason that we do them in Pali is to affirm our history. This is not something that we have created afresh. This is not something unique to us. We are part of a tradition that has been all over the world and has been practiced now for around 2,600 years. And one of the other values of doing them in Pali is that if you ever go to a pan-Buddhist gathering or you sit with other communities, they may also do them in Pali. And then regardless of translation, there's this point of familiarity. And these, we take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And the Buddha, and this taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha is what it means to walk this Dharma path, what it means to use these tools to be part of this tradition. This isn't a matter of being a Buddhist in some ontological or metaphysical sense. And in fact, in Asian languages, there isn't a word Buddhist. That's actually an English innovation. But taking refuge is... It is how we commit ourselves to the path. And even if you're in an exploratory phase with regard to all of this bizarreness, it's just taking refuge in this moment, taking refuge for this period of Zazen, availing ourselves of the three treasures, the first of which is the Buddha. And the Buddha is both the... historical person who started all of this in India 2,600 years ago, who was just a person like us, filled with blind passions, continually tossed about by the energies of grasping, aversion, and stories. So it is this historical person who realized something so profound that we're feeling its ripples, its effects here tonight. And the Buddha described himself not as inventing anything new or discovering the Dharma. The Dharma kind of was always there. Or in this path, but he described himself as walking back and forth on a path through woods where there was no path, creating a path by walking back and forth inwardly in his mind, exploring the way, what it is to be human, what it is to use our mind, what it is that causes suffering, what it is that brings liberation amid suffering. And he explored this so thoroughly that those of us who would come after him would then have a trail through the woods that we could follow, a path that had not previously been there. And taking refuge in that path is part of what we're doing. And so the Buddha is this, the historical Buddha. The Buddha is also our own capacity for awakening. And the word Buddha means awakened one. Our own capacity to wake up to the wake up to this moment, wake up to choiceful presence in our life, wake up to a life in which we're able to choose our actions and align our intentions. And this is also the Buddha that we bow to at the beginning. Taking refuge. So amid the storm, the tossings and turnings of life, all of the slings and arrows, everything coming at us, the pain that is inescapable, we go for refuge. This path is fundamentally a refuge. Doesn't mean we hide from anything here. It doesn't mean we get away from it. It doesn't mean we find a state of mind and body or even a place like a monastery where we can hide from the world as a refuge. Like, that's not that kind of refuge. It's refuge right in the middle of it. But it is real refuge. And then we take refuge in the Dharma. The Dharma is the teachings, the explicit teachings of this tradition. And it's the universe itself and all of the individual phenomena in it. Those are dharmas. All of this is the Dharma. And the word Dharma also means the truth and the way. And we take refuge in the truth of this moment. We take refuge in the way things in fact are. And we take refuge in the Sangha. The Sangha is the community. It's the community of all of us here in this room. It's the community of the Buddhist practitioners in general. And it's the community of all beings. And none of this work, except in exceedingly rare circumstances, and the Buddha himself was one of these rare circumstances. None of this work can be done alone. It is so infinitely much more difficult to do alone. And this is why we gather together. And you may find it's easier to sit zazen here with us than it is at home. And that is part of the truth of the matter. And that this is why Sangha is so important. And then strengthening these capacities amid Sangha, we find that we can take that strengthened capacity elsewhere and feel the Sangha even in different ways. And there's the literal qualities of having spiritual friends, having people committed to this life of freedom and liberation and causing less harm, and having this is the Sangha. And the Buddha said that the single most important thing in a spiritual life is to have good spiritual friends, to surround yourself with people who care about this, who are walking this path, however we construe it. And so we take refuge. These are the three refuges, also called the three jewels. And then we do the five remembrances. And if you have happened to make it through these bizarre bowings without too much reactivity, if you've managed to chant this word karma, which you may not know, and this word evil, which you probably know and have some strong opinions about, and then get through these foreign languages, like then and chant these gibberish sounding things, then we get to the five remembrances, which for many people are the most provocative. And challenging features of this short liturgy. And these, and they are extremely powerful, extremely important. These, all of the liturgy, the three pieces at the beginning and the one piece we'll do at the end, all of these together kind of define the scope of what it is that we're practicing, the sphere we're practicing in. And they make, they define, they help us see this practice, they help us differentiate this Zen Buddhist practice as a Dharma practice, as a spiritual practice, not just a, not a practice of relaxation, not a practice of just getting into some lovely state of mind, not a practice of trying to feel something, and not something that we do in order to be anything other than human. And so we affirm these truths, that we are of the nature to grow old, and there's no way to escape growing old, to have ill health, and there's no way to escape having ill health. We're of the nature to die, and there's no way to escape death. These also are the three of what are called the four messengers. So the Buddha, before he became the Buddha, was a prince of the royal house of India, and was kept in such a protected environment that he had never seen anything other than the most beautiful people and circumstances and stuff. And he one time went out on a trip and saw an old person and saw a sick person and saw a dead person. And that awakened in him the desire, the urgent need to get to the bottom of this matter of life and death. And that's, this is another synonym for what it is that we are practicing, this great matter of life and death. And then the fourth messenger was, he saw an ascetic. He saw somebody doing religious practices. And one of the ways that these five remembrances function is kind of like a inoculation. And for me, by affirming these things, by saying I am of the nature to have ill health, I am of the nature to grow old. All that is dear to me and everyone I love are of the nature of change, and there's no way to avoid being separate from them. Then when these circumstances arise in our lives, as they inevitably will, rather than somehow being shocked, my God, I'm sick, God, I can't deal with this, or shocked at change, or rather than being only shocked, we're also able to affirm, Yeah, this is that thing that happens for human beings. And we're such a death-denying and old-age-denying and sick-denying culture. We put these images away, kind of like the Buddha in that protected castle. And we imagine we can, and then that enables us to maintain the fantasy that we can get through life without encountering those. And none of us can. And by taking up the practice of awareness of sickness, old age, death, loss, change, by doing this when we are not necessarily most actively in the throes of them, in the grasp of them, then at other points in our life, we're able to build a set of skills, we're able to start to change our relationship to those things so that when they do come up in their most dramatic forms, we are able to meet them differently. And that is fundamentally what this practice is about. And then the fifth one is that my deeds are my closest companions. I'm the beneficiary of my deeds. And my deeds are the ground of which I stand, on which I stand. This is, again, a teaching of karma. This is this, and one of the things that this points to is that whenever we do any action, wholesome or unwholesome, harming or supporting, the first place that is always, the first place that effect always takes place is within us. And the Buddha used the image of reaching in to grab a hot coal out of the fire to throw at your enemy in anger. The first thing that happens is you burn your hand. And this is always the case with these energies of grasping, aversion, and certainty, ignorance. And the ground on which I stand is the place where we have to, the place that we have to be at one with to start. And then the last piece of the liturgy that we do is the four bodhisattva vows. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. The Buddha way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. First of all, these are all impossible on the one hand, and that challenges for us, kind of frames for us what it is that we are doing and can doing and can do. And returning to these bodhisattva vows, our aspirations to free all beings throughout space and time, to cut through all delusions that rise endlessly, to enter each Dharma gate that arises for us, and to really live this path of choiceful presence, of less harming, of kindness and skillfulness. These are our vows. These are the things that we are continually reorienting to. And so there's a kind of three-part image that I use. We reorient to our bodhisattva vows, our bodhisattva aspirations, also the guidance of the moral and ethical teachings of the precepts. We use those to guide us, to aim at. And then we fall short, inevitably, because they're impossible, not least of all, but also because we remain human with all of this grasping, aversion, and certainty. We fall short of those aspirations, and then we need to atone. Again, we need to acknowledge the reality of our having fallen short, of our having gotten caught up in those energies, and then atoning with that, being at one, acknowledging that reality as our starting place, we again reorient to the bodhisattva vows and move forward. And we fall short, atone, reorient. And this, one of the things that the first of these bodhisattva vows, beings are numberless, I vow to free them. One of the most important things that this reminds us of is that this practice is, in a really important way, not about you. It's not unrelated to you. But this path, this Zen Buddhist Dharma practice, is not about anything so small as how are you doing? How am I doing right now? How about now? And this is and one of the things that this reminds us of is that there's nothing we can hold on to. This is a practice that we need to give it all away. And so we in our chant we say, I vow to free them all, these numberless beings. We might also, so other versions say, I vow to save them all. And both of those words are provocative in their own way. And so while it's true that this is a path in which we deeply, deeply commit, in fact, we vow over and over again to save all beings, this isn't a matter of saving that being and then going over there and saving back that being and then getting that being. It's all beings throughout space and time. All beings throughout space and time. And, in fact, it's also true that we can't save even a single being. And amid that truth, we make this vow. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Greed, anger, and ignorance rise endlessly. I vow to cut through them each time they come up. I vow to see that they've arisen. And unhook from that and again return to being the person I mean to be. And delusions are never exhausted once and for all. Aiming at, or worse still, imagining that you've attained some state where all delusions or even any delusions are exhausted is among the greatest and most pernicious and dangerous of the delusions that can arise. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. They're as wide as your life. They're as wide as each moment. And you can't enter the Dharma gates once and for all and then be in and all set. You've got to do it over and over and over again. The Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. This is particularly affirming and welcoming because you can't miss. And we have to work with that even when we're certain we've totally missed. The Buddha way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody. Also, this can be translated as the Buddha way is unattainable. I vow to attain it. It's not something you can get and have. And it's also not nothing. This is a little kind of extended orientation to what this whole bizarre endeavor that has been so world transforming for me, literally life saving for me, and for generations of people, it is about. And when we do the dedication, which is the other part of that, the part that the chant leader reads by himself, that's a giving away of the merit of our practice. That's giving our practice away to all beings and acknowledging the way that all beings, the world itself, and centuries and millennia and hundreds and hundreds of generations of people have kept alive this set of tools for us to meet this moment right now. And so it's reflecting in gratitude on that too. In my mind, I imagined this was going to be a briefer talk. But it wasn't. But I still do want to leave a little bit of space for you to either ask questions about any piece of this, or if you've been doing this practice for a while, if you've been chanting these things, saying these things, using your body, mind, and speech in this way, to say a little bit about some piece of it that has resonated with you or been useful to you or unfolded interestingly for you. So, there open is the floor for that.
Why do we do some of them three times? And say from personal experience that when I first started doing this with you guys, it was, I would do, you know, the first time and then be like, really? Two more times? Felt like a lot too much. And, but then now after a while, I actually really value doing it two times. And I'm not really sure why.
In that space of not really sure why, can you add a few more words to that?
I guess I feel like my experience of the first time and the third time in the given sitting is very different. Mm-hmm. And maybe by the time I get to the third one, I'm less thinking about it, more about it.
Mm-hmm. So it's a really good question, and that points to another way that the liturgy works in all kinds of kind of devious ways. So part of the answer to why do we do it one time rather than three times, part of it is arbitrary. Part of it is in fact arbitrary, and part of it is time saving. But traditionally, actually, they'd almost all be done three times, at least three times. So why do we do them three times at all? And you're touching some of that. My experience is also that it helps it kind of penetrate a little more. It's easy to just kind of yeah our way through it once. And then it comes around again, and it comes around again, and so it kind of helps it penetrate more deeply into your being. And part of it is related to that all of this used to be an oral tradition, and repetition is one of the ways that oral traditions are maintained. And so there's a way that it kind of also enhances the provocative quality of it, and especially with the Gatha of Atonement, for instance, one of the things that the repetition does is it underscores the fact that it isn't something that you do, that I atone for it all. Okay, next thing. And even right now I atone for it all, still we do it two more times, even ritually. And with the five remembrances, which are so provocative and can be so challenging and painful to say, meeting that again and again is powerful. And whatever you're experiencing as we're doing any part of this liturgy is part of what it's for. And it's not, even if what you're experiencing is, my God, I hate this, this is such a waste of time, there's something really valuable to be met and worked with there too. And the repetition helps make things more provocative. Thank you. Really?
I'm always good for one. I had forgotten until you, for some reason, I mean, we say these over and over, but I had forgotten until you were actually talking about the four vows, that the first session that I went to, of course, on retreats, we say these, I don't know, umpteen times.
Probably 12 times a day.
Yeah, a bunch, and it was a three-day retreat. So on the very last day at the end, when I went in to see one of the teachers, it suddenly struck me that last line where it says, I vow to embody it, really meant that it wasn't just something that we were doing, you know, like inside with some internal thing. It was actually embodied, like we live it. So It only took that long to get through to me.
Yeah. I mean, there's all kinds of aha moments like that. Like one of the other chants, if we were to, the only chant that's missing from this that is in its own way essential, but it's only essential in one line, is the Heart Sutra, which says form is exactly emptiness, emptiness exactly form. And, you know, you chant that, and that's on retreat, you chant it every day, in a Zen monastery, chant it every day, over and over. And then at some point, you realize, oh, wait a minute, form is exactly emptiness. Emptiness is exactly form. God, if only somebody had tried to tell me that.
I have a question, but it's not about the liturgy that you just read, so I don't know if I should save it until the end.
Sure.
Well, I guess, you know, it's my first time coming, and for some reason I can't stop wondering about the altar and, like, what the significance of the object. It was one of the first things that caught my eye, and then I'm just wondering why is there a place, or even why to have it.
And so part of it is as a provocation. And part of it is to remind us when we're bowing to the Buddha, who is not that statue and not a guy outside of ourselves. And the elements of it, the traditional altar, represent the senses, which is one way of inclusively including the whole universe. Part of it is that there's a functional quality, there's a kind of liturgical quality in which an altar dignifies the space in a certain way. It consecrates it, but not in a magical kind of way. Just a reminder to us that here is where something important takes place, and just like the bounds. And so many people find, even if they have no particular affinity towards objects and altars and stuff like that, they find that as their practice goes on, they do want to have an altar at home. And one form the altar can take is of three decreasingly sized stones stacked on top of each other. That's called a stone Buddha. That's something that many people find in their house. And they put it near where they may sit, and it reminds you, it reminds us of this endeavor and the importance of this endeavor, much like the liturgy.
Are all those objects that you said supposed to represent the five the senses? And then the Buddha is supposed to represent the idea of the Buddha, not like the Buddha the person, but...
All of that, all of those are facets.
Okay.
I've always found the five remembrances to be the most interesting to me, I guess, or the most, maybe the most relatable, just because, kind of like you said, we are in this culture of denying death and denying old age. I think it's useful and helpful just to remember at least once a week. Because when it does come up in life, it's very seems more real than anything else we ever chant. Mm-hmm. You know, when like someone you know dies or something,
yeah,
you're not like, oh, but emptiness, so it's okay.
Right.
You know, that's like it. That's so. I think the five realms have always like struck me in a very very real way.
Yeah. My father died by suicide a number of years ago, like 4 or 5 years ago, and I have never been so grateful for the five remembrances than in meeting that. And I felt like it gave me a context and a capacity to meet this excruciating pain and difficulty and sorrow, but to be able to recognize that including that too is part of what the great matter is about. And I also also struggle with chronic illness and kind of recurrent depression, and the five remembrances are also helpful to me in meeting those things when they come, for exactly those reasons. How about you old timers who have been reciting these for years? James Morgan?
Just the part about things being boundless and working with, even though you're certain, I'm certain, I totally missed, totally screwed up, totally messed up. Working with that and seeing that work hard enough. A couple things that I guess come up for me in all these years of doing this. One is the word atonement, and struggling with sort of what I thought was the Christian way of thinking about it, and not really thinking about it as, you know, starting again, starting afresh. And then the other part is in the five remembrances that I've seen that really struck me the most is the all that appears in everyone I love is our other nature of change. You know, being a parent and seeing your kids grow, but just so that's sort of the good part of change, but also knowing that that's just only one, a few of the beginning chapters of things. And watching myself change, and my wife change, and knowing that there's yet more change to go on, hopefully for a very long time. And this, five remembrances, just knowing that that change is just ever present. It's almost comforting because it's something you can count on.
Yeah.
Even when things are really bad, you know, well, things are going to change. Perhaps it'll get worse, but you know, the chance you can get better.
Yeah, that's part of the refuge quality too, yeah. And recognizing that when we're like, oh my God, everything changes. Yeah, everything changes. Yeah. Thank you.
I wanted to try to speak to the not words experience of the liturgy.
Yeah.
And, to just spend a lot of time on the work, but for me there's always been kind of when I can't figure out the words, and there's too many words, and I'm just confused and frustrated, there's an element of the sound and the voices coming together, and which has always meant more to me. I thought I would be sitting here except for the chanting practice. And because there's something about when all the words are so confusing and so impossible to figure out that kind of lifts it beyond that to something that you can experience. And it doesn't mean that, you know, it sounds good idea that you've got your head inside of a bell. So anyway, I wanted to not word part of chanting.
Thank you. Thank you for giving voice to that important part. And there are also chants that we do that have no meaning, which help us access this thing, this quality that Arlene is pointing to.
Because one of my favorite things that you always said was when we were doing the memorial service, and it was the Dharanis, which have always been a little bit difficult to me, but you said that the Dharanis are when there are no words, and all you can do is just, and it's just when something is beyond words, it becomes another form of
Yeah, beautifully expressed, beautifully expressed. The Dharanis are the chants that have no literal meaning, that look like gibberish syllables that we do in our long service but not a short one. And they are a way of responding to the universe, to great suffering, to unimaginable pain, where no words can capture it, but still where no action changes it, but still some response is required. And the Dharanis are a model of how we can respond with our hearts beyond actions, beyond ideas, beyond words. Thank you.
I guess just another thing concerning words, which is like after your talk, you know, you're like, are there any questions? And sometimes when I hear a really interesting or dynamic talk like you just gave, I feel like it's hard for me to even articulate a question, because like when I hear a good discussion of what this is all about, like it dissolves ideas that I had that defined it, or that I thought defined it. So I don't know how you can talk about this. Like whenever, sometimes I try to explain some of these ideas to other people, and I'm just like getting farther away from what like I'm trying to express sometimes with the words. So I just find it a funny contradictory thing sometimes.
And sometimes we need to go deeply into that words can't capture it, can't find any words to talk about it, to go deeply into that and really familiarize ourselves with it. And then that we can come out the other end and sometimes have something to say. But I appreciate both sides of what you said, which is that... which is a good reminder to me, and not, which is something actually that Kate often reminds me of, is that it's often hard to find words after the talk, and that it's not that. Which is why I'm particularly grateful when people really take up this in fact difficult practice of diving in and sharing something. In the service of all beings. It's really a practice of generosity and a practice of supporting the Sangha to take up this difficult practice. And it's, it's difficult to talk about it, although talking is kind of my thing and words are kind of my thing. That's just my specific thing, but still there's a way that words always miss it. Words are the wrong size container, the wrong kind of container to meet this stuff. And yet, in the words of one 20th century Japanese Zen teacher, you've got to say something. Thank you. So that is perhaps a good place to leave it, and let us now take up this practice of chanting these four Bodhisattva vows.